Okay, Sir John, we of course ran out of tape there just a second ago, but you said you had lost an oil line and were wondering about going to Switzerland. Now, and you ended up making it.
Right. We ended up escorting the B-26 back to the base. He ended up bailing in at our base. And in fact, when the flight leader said, John, take him home, I said, well, you know, I'm just a wingman. Where's home? He said, well, call baby, take up a heading of 270 degrees. When you hit the Rhine River, call baby, he'll take you home. And that's how we radar told him what base that you wanted to go to.
Now, let me make sure I understand. When you escorted this
B-26,
how often did you ever get tasked to escort bombers?
That's the only time.
That was just that one time?
The only time.
And this was a long B-26?
No, you were
picking up the whole formation?
Oh, yeah. There was.
I wasn't sure if it was a B-26 that got hit and that you just happened to come across and trying to help them get home safely.
No, they had a whole group up, I don't know, 12, 15 aircraft over a regular bomb run. And when this one got hit and then two of us were complaining about having aircraft problems, they said, hey, latch onto this guy and take him home if he can make it. So that's why we, you know, just showing that the Germans come up, you got two fighters and one bomber, figured we could support him.
So you were primarily in a fighter-bomber role, of course, there was this one time where you escorted a B-26 mission.
It was the old Marauder B-26, by the way.
Sure. Do you remember roughly when that was? Well, I guess March or April.
It was in April sometime, had to be.
Probably April of 45.
Yeah,
okay.
Had to be. Right near the end of
that window there.
Right.
Okay. Now, we talked about the fighter threat, primarily the 262, that caused you concern, and you got jumped that one time when you had a change in tactics where you sent, had more aircraft go down. And other than that, I gather you didn't have too many concerns about the 109s or that they weren't so, you know, they weren't prevalent at that point.
No, they weren't prevalent. Like I say, the main thing was the 262s that gave us problems. See, at the time, right at the end of the war there, we strafed or dive bombed munition yards, trains, you know, locomotives. At that time, anything that moved for us was more or less of a target of opportunity. And since we were supporting the 10th and 12th Armored Tank Division, they would call us in and say, hey, we need a such and such strafe, or we'd like to have an area bombed. Now, we carried three different types of bombs. We carried a 500-pound contact demo when it, of course, don't worry about it. That's my phone. I'll catch it later.
Okay.
You want to stop the tape?
Yeah, I
go
better
and
go ahead and stop the tape
while
we take care of the phone.
Sure.
Okay, we just had a little phone call there, and John was talking about the targets that he hit as then the types of bombs he used.
Okay, we had, I think, we carried two 500-pound bombs and a 150-gallon belly tank for our range for fuel. On the bombs, we carried fragmentation bombs, like 32 in a cluster, and we carried incendiaries. So when we go in, say, to hit a factory area or a munitions dump, we drop the two 500-pound bombs. The group or whoever in the flight had the 500-pound demos, he would drop his first. Then we drop the fragmentation bombs to break it up, and then we dropped incendiary bombs. And we were supposed to bring our belly tank back, but it always seemed that the guy that had the incendiaries always lost his belly tank. We don't know why, but anyway, it helped the fire alarm, and because we were getting short of belly tanks, so they were wanting us to bring them home anyway. But that's how we operated. Now, for instance, we had a deal around Nuremberg, which is where our prisoner of war camp was. Now, they had a train that had moved in behind the camp, and they said it was full of ammunition. This is what we had on our briefing, and we were strafing. And they told us to go in a certain way, that there was a church that we had to stay to the left side of when we strafed, so none of our stray bullets would get into the prisoner of war camp at Nuremberg. So we strafed the train, and we got it burning, and it was doing great when we left. It's 45. In 1953, when I got recalled back on active duty, at one of the bases we got shooting the breeze one night, and I mentioned about Nuremberg, and it's been a B-17 pilot. He said, well, I was at Nuremberg. He said, that train that you guys shot up and burned up didn't have any munition. That was our blankets, our care packages, and Red Cross packages. Now, this was in February. He said, so tonight, John, you sleep under a sheet. He says, we'd like to froze to death because you got to burn up all our supplies. But that was just intelligent then, you know. And I'm sure that a lot of that happened.
Well, to what extent did you encounter when you were strafing trains or any other targets your concern about, hey, this thing's going to go off like a powder keg? And
a steam engine locomotive, if he was running down the track and had steam up, yes, he's going to blow. But if he's sitting along a siding, normally you could see your 850 caliber going right into him, your tracer, but he would never blow. He didn't have enough steam up. He had to generally be running down the track. So if you caught him in the marshaling yard itself or on a track by itself, 9 times out of 10 they wouldn't blow, but you knew that you'd done damage to it. Maybe they wouldn't be able to run down the tracks the next day, you know.
And what I imagine, because they were getting attacked so much that most of the times you caught them stationary, not so often in transit.
Right. Well, for instance, like I said, the one that didn't blow, the one day we were trying to close up a railroad track on a cut, and once in a while when we went down and we had either a manual or electric release on to release your bombs, that particular day I went down and pulled up 2,000 feet and I used the electric release. Well, only one 500-pound bomb left the airplane, so I still had 500 pounds in the other wing. And when you pull up, going back up to 18,000 feet, you do real nice barrel rolls with that one 500-pound bomb on the other wing. But as I pulled up, and it was only maybe 3,000 or 4,000 feet in the air, the guy behind me called and said, John, you're on fire. And it turned out that I guess the ground fire got my belly tank, and so I just jettisoned the belly tank. Luckily, that whatever hit the belly tank didn't hit that other 5-pound bomb. So another airplane did the same thing. So we made a second run on that same target. We normally did not make two runs on the same target, but I had to get rid of the bomb. So we went down, and luckily I didn't get any more ground weak. They were shot asked whether any more ground fire on the airplane. You got rid of the other bomb.
Well, as I recall from my Air Force days, even though I wasn't a pilot and now I'm a civilian, I remember the phrase often heard, one pass, haul ass. Don't linger.
That's right. In fact, we made 3 passes that day. My flight leader wanted to go down and strafe the engines. He ended up flying. He got fixation and actually flew through the top of the tree. We thought he was going to go into the side of the hill. We kept telling him to pull up, to pull up. He put a big hole in the leading edge of the wing of the P-47. And I pulled up alongside of him. He had oil all over the windshield. He's fishtailing. And I told the squadron leader, I said, hey, he's got a problem, the flight leader. And I said, he's acting. He can't talk on the radio. And I said, I know he flew through those pine trees because I was right behind him and I was stacked up above him. And he said, well, we're going on our secondary target. You go ahead and take him on home. And I'm like, say, home, where's home? Called baby and took the guy back home. But I guess as far as my combat, that was about the closest, I guess. He got hit and get the belly tank on fire and got rid of it.
So that near miss was probably your closest call.
I would say, as far as I know. You know, when you go down a dive bomb run, when you're sitting and looking at the other guys going down, and you see all this flak coming up at you, it looks like a tornado almost. You think, God, I got to go down there next, you know. But when you start the dive bomber, you don't think anything about it. You're concentrating on your target. And you don't even think about it.
To what extent did you come back and count holes in your aircraft?
So luckily, I never got another hole.
I imagine some guys had some Swiss cheese.
No. Well, when we strafed the aerodrome at Stuttgart, Germany, we lost one aircraft. Later on, after World War II, in June of 45, we found the aircraft. It had 63 holes in it. Now, he survived. He bellied the aircraft in about a mile off into the runway. And, of course, he was just a prisoner of war for, I think, 3 weeks. That was right during the end of World War II.
Now, did you and your fellow pilots have concerns that at that point in the war, if you went down, if you thought you might be just shot on sight by the locals,
well,
or
Yes.
Or in the prison camp, that they wouldn't treat you in accordance with the Geneva Convention, that they were losing the war and they didn't really care to treat you.
Yes. Our biggest threat was the civilians. We were known as the Yabo pilots. That was J-A-B-O-O. Now, they had brainwashed the women and children that all we were Chicago gangsters, and all we did was dive bomb, strafe women and children. Because, sure, we had marshaling yards, and we had cities and stuff like that, and I'm sure there were civilians. No, and they were really brainwashed, because later on, back in 52, when I was a flight instructor, we had a block party, and our house was used more or less as a bathroom, I guess, and this lady came through and saw pictures of my P-47s on the wall, and she said to my wife, "Was your husband a Yabo pilot?" She said, "Yes." She said, "Had I known him, I would have hated his guts," says, "we were grieved that they were Chicago gangsters." Now, we had, after World War II, in June, we had a guy lose an engine, and he bellied into a wheat field in Germany. And the guys flew over, and he waved at him, and they got the coordinates, sent a jeep after him, and it was probably 6 or 8 hours before they got to him. But when they got there, the German women in that area had taken him into the barn, and they had used a pitchfork on him. They had mutilated him. Like the week before, we'd taken the 45s off. We didn't wear them anymore. After that happened, we put the 45s back on. But they still had out. You know, you had to realize these people were fighting a war. You were their enemy. And even though the war had ended, they probably had their husbands or something killed, so that they're going to retaliate. And they did this for a while, you know, after the war. A month or two after, and you can understand that.
A month or two after the...
After the war was over with, sure, I'm sure that in isolated areas...
You were still having incidents, so...
Yeah, it was mainly communication lines and stuff like that. They were still cutting lines out and everything.
That fellow that got caught in the barn with the pitchforks, yeah. I mean, they didn't get to him in time?
Our group time, they sent a jeep to go pick him up, got the coordinates and everything, got to the farmhouse. No.
They had already killed him?
They'd already killed him. That's true. You know, so our 45s went back on.
Yeah.
And they were civilians. You know, they weren't the German army itself.
So when we talk about threats, we talked about the fighters, talked about the flak, we talked about the civilians here. We talked about to what extent a target might actually blow up on you and get you that way.
Yeah.
Were there any other combat concerns that you had, combat-related concerns? Or you mentioned how even the presence of motorcycles was, in fact, causing different losses or injuries and such. Did you have many non-combat losses due to collisions in the weather or things of that nature?
We've climbed out through a bunch of bad weather, and you ended up and you look over and you see a guy about 3 feet from you, but you didn't know he was there until you broke out of the cloud. Like one day they said, "Oh well, clouds are only 8,000-10,000 feet, you break out on top, you be." Well, we started climbing out in an echelon. We ended up breaking out at 19,000 feet on top. And now, I mentioned that the 47 was a high altitude fighter. Now, going through training at Richmond, we had to make a one high altitude flight. I think the service ceiling on a jug is 43,000 feet. I flew at night at 41,000 feet on a night flight out of Richmond on a cross country. We had to go to high altitude, and we said, "This buddy and I said, well, let's take it up and see how high it'll go." So we went to 41,000 feet. And you're not pressurized or anything, you're just breathing on an oxygen, but you never thought anything about it, you know.
Way up there.
Oh yeah, it's quite a ways up there, yeah.
So the threats, so you didn't really encounter the non-operational losses due to weather or other circumstances? And when you were flying out of France, the locals having endured Nazi occupation, how did the French treat you?
I don't know. We never got downtown very much.
Pretty much on base.
Pretty much on the base. You know, the town was real close by, but I don't know. You were always busy doing other things, and we didn't get a chance to go out and see the countryside. It ended up, as far as that was about my experience as far as flying the jug, but then, like I say, I went the last 30 days up the front lines as a forward air controller. That was very interesting.
Now, tell me about that. To what extent did you find yourself under the gun there?
Well, I ended up with a Jeep, had a driver and a radio operator, and myself, and then we had a trailer we pull all the radio gear and stuff with. This captain we had as a tank commander, I don't know, he and I got along real good. I happened to have a P-47 painted on the back of my jacket, and of course, they called me Flyboy at the time. But anyway, we generally rode about behind number 3 tank. He tried his best to get me checked out in the tank, but I said, no, no. Anyway, what he would do when he'd run into a resistance, he'd come back and tell me he wanted fighters for either for strafing or dive bombing. And it was my job to call in to Baby and Foxtrot, the different controllers. I'd set up my antenna and stuff and give them the coordinates and find out from radar people if there was any aircraft in that area, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes away. And then when they would call me a flight, say you got a flight due within 10 minutes, then I'd contact the flight leader, talk to him, find out what kind of bombs he had on, and tell him what the tank captain told me, what he wanted to troop strafe, or don't blow up that bridge, we need that bridge to cross the bridge, or strafe around it, or drop the bombs on it. And that was my job of controlling it.
Now, where were you in relation to the tank column leader?
100 yards back, maybe, or so.
100 yards back.
Oh, you're right
with
him, yeah.
Within the column.
Because the day that he almost taught me to check out in the tank, number 2 tank ran over a mine and blew the track off, ran it up at 75 mil up a tree, and I said, no way, Captain, I'm staying in my damn Jeep. And, for instance, they were taking over a town, and it was kind of hilly, and being a greenhorn up there, I was standing up in the Jeep and told a radio operator, I said, look, I said, they got 24 millimeter, but they're firing the other direction. And about that time, I woke up in a ditch. He had thrown me out of the Jeep, and he says, Flyboy, look above your head, and about 10 feet above our head, the bullets were going in the side of a building. He said, the tracers I saw were coming at us. Of course, I'd never been on it. I didn't know the difference. But if the guys liked you up there in that 10th Armored Tank Division, fine. But if they didn't, just stay out of their way. But I had a good group, had a good rapport with the guys. And they saved my butt a couple of times, just because I didn't know any difference.
Well, you mentioned the one just now with the bullets whizzing overhead.
Sure.
What was the other time, or other times?
About the second day up there, of course, they're telling you about hitting the landmines and all that stuff. Well, as we went by, I said, hey, look, they got about 6 or 8 155 howitzers. They're aimed, and we had a little S turn in the road. And they said, oh, yeah. So when we passed in front of them, I think they let all those suckers go with the Jeep, and I swear that Jeep jumped 10 feet in the air. I left the Jeep, figured that we had been hit by a landmine. But it was strictly a routine thing that they did when you went up the front line to get you checked out, get you combat ready. But no, that and the night that we took the town, half of the town belonged to the Germans. And you
do you remember the town involved?
It sounded like it was Shanggao, but it's almost like a Chinese town, but the name of it was Shanggao, I recall.
And this was?
In Germany, in Austria area.
Austria. Germany.
So, but I that night though, the guys got into town, they found a wine cellar, and they had food in this restaurant type of thing, and they told me, he said, Flyboy, you're sleeping in a German doctor's house tonight, it's down a block or two. Well, the boys that got into this German schnapps, potato schnapps, I don't know if you ever drank any of that, but if you swallow it, then you can probably be like a blowtorch and put a fire out of probably 50 feet away. But we'd had a few drinks, and I walked out, and the guard hollered, halt, give me the password. And I said, I don't know the password. And I started to turn around, And when I did, I heard him click the safety off of that M16, and you sober up real quick. And I said, look, I'm the flyboy. I said, call a sergeant of guard. So that's what he called sergeant of guard. He said, oh, yeah, that's a flyboy. He's okay. So where are you going? I said, well, I got an address. I'm going down to spend the night in his house. And he said, okay, I'll take you. I said, look, Sarge, go in and get somebody the password. No one has told us what the password is tonight. Somebody's liable to get shot. And that was, you know, pretty close incident. But his home I stayed in was a beautiful home that this doctor had, one of these great big feather beds and everything. And but you didn't get that very often.
Now, you mentioned you spent the last month of the war, roughly mid-April to, of course, the 8th of May when he surrendered was as a forward air controller.
Yeah.
What was the typical duration for a pilot to be assigned in that role?
30 days.
A month at a time?
A month at a time. Actually, what we did, it was, since three of us were going, one is supposed to fly the L-5 observation. The other two was going to the 10th of Tarpa, 12th Armored Tank Division. And one guy was flying the L-5, he said, you know, I don't want to fly that thing for 30 days. It's not conducive to longevity. That's worse than crop dusting. Anyway, so what we did, we flipped a coin. We figured, well, they don't know who's coming up there. They just know they got a bunch of pilots. So we flipped a coin. So the first 10 days, I flew the L-5 for observation with an observer in it and going over for troops for the 10th and 12th. After my 10 days were up, then I ended up actually the last 20 days with the 10th Armored Tank Division. And we were on our way, our group was on our way to Innsbruck through the pass. We ended up at Garmisch, Park in Garmisch, the day the war ended.
Now, did you say three pilots got assigned for a 30-day
tours?
It's the only raffle
I ever won. You know, they're supposed to take your name out of a hat.
So one being flying the L-5 or for some period thereof.
Yeah, sure.
One being assigned to the 10th and another being assigned
12.
To the 12th.
Since we were supporting them.
Now, did you say that they all three came from the same squadron at a time or from the group?
No, same group.
From the same group.
One pilot at each squadron.
One for each squadron.
Yeah.
Okay.
One pilot at each squadron.
Okay. Now, you mentioned, you know, the concern about mines. To what extent did the column you work with hit mines?
Well, we had a couple of that one time with that one tank, and then the right after that. Then what they did, they brought in like a tank that had like a big roller in the front of it, like for rolling grass.
For mine,
they put that in front, and then he'd run down the road you were going down to set off any mines that were in place.
So they were pretty good about making sure they.
Oh yeah, it was mine free. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then apparently they got careless on that one time.
To what extent did you get encounter snipers?
Well, being about behind the third tank, we were fairly, you know, far enough behind that. Now, we did have an ME, FW-190 strafus one day. He was making one pass across the column when we heard him coming in. Tank commander says, flyboy, call and get some help. So instead of going through normal procedures, I made a blank call into the air to see if there's any aircraft, and I gave the coordinates that we had. I got a call back from a P-51 pilot, recce pilot. And he said, I'm a recce pilot. I'm probably 10 minutes away from the coordinates you gave me. And I said, we got a FW-190 strafeness. I said, he's made one run, and he's coming around for another one. I said, you got any ammo? And he said, yeah. See, a lot of the guys flying the recce didn't carry ammo with them. They carried cameras, you know. So anyway, I gave him the position of it, and as the FW-190 was like on a base leg getting ready to turn, the 51 says, hey, I got him, hold your fire. So tank connect, and they passed it on down, nobody to fire from the tank group. And as he come across, he didn't hit anything, and the 51 was right behind him, and when he was about 200 foot off the deck, the 51 was able to get him, and he rolled inverted and went in the ground. So the guy in the 51 come back.
Did his victory roll.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, buddy. And I said, you're welcome. Of course, later on down the road, I got chewed out by the major who was at the home base because I didn't go through proper procedures.
But heck, you got that F-190 off the column.
Well, I got 51, an aircraft, and that's all I was concerned about at the time, being a pilot, you know. He got him an aircraft.
Yeah.
And no one else got hurt on the ground.
In your column that you were
with,
yeah.
But, like I say, with the major, he chewed me out, but he didn't get a cherry.
Yeah, and the bottom line is you served right. The mission well, yeah. Yes.
Luckily. Now, as war ended, this sergeant I had and radio operator, these guys were great scroungers and stuff. We were not supposed to go out of the city of Garmisch at the end of the war. 2 days later, they said, hey, flyboy, we're going to go out of town and we're looking around because there had been a bunch of German troops that they had picked up and put in into an internment camp at Garmisch.
You're saying this is 2 days after the war
ended? After the war ended of 8th, yeah, about the 10th of May. It was where they had stripped them down and everything. So these guys were out. It was in a wooded area. The guys were looking for knives and Lugers and this type of thing. Anyway, as we're out in this area, three Germans come walking across the pasture with like a handkerchief on the end of a stick. So we grabbed our guns. They come up and, oh, we got three prisoners of war. It turned out one of them had his arm in a sling, in a cast. And as I turned around with my jacket, he says, oh, a Yabo pilot. And I said, yeah, well, Sergeant Crutcher was his name, was my driver. He could speak very fluent German. And this German pilot says, Yabo pilot. And I said, yeah. And so they talked to him back and forth, and I said, what did he say? And he says, well, a P-47 shot him down. When he bailed out, he broke his arm. He was a pilot. And I said, I didn't shoot anybody down, so it wasn't me. Anyway. The other personnel was a navigator. He had a big navigator watch that the radio operator took. And the other one was the ground personnel and maintenance. So we put them on the Jeep and turned them into the camp. Now we checked for knives and stuff. They didn't have any. As the pilot was getting off of the Jeep going in, he turned around and he said, here. And he handed me this. This is his pilot's wings.
Oh my. I'm picking up.
Memento.
Memento here with...
It's the metal German pilot wings from this FW-190 pilot that we picked up outside of Garmisch after World War II.
With a laurel wreath with a very large, what appears to be an eagle with spread wings, and the eagle is resting on a swastika that's at the bottom of the laurel wreath. I think what I'll try and do is take a photo of this to include with the interview. Just for someone's reference, if they want to see what I'm trying to describe here.
And I have kicked myself ever since why I haven't ever tried to look that guy up and find out what happened. He might have been president of Mercedes or something, you know, since I was stationed in England 20 years later.
So even though, as you mentioned, I didn't shoot you down.
No,
it wasn't me. He freely offered this to you.
He come out of his lining with his coat, and he's here, flyboy, Yabo. And handed it to me before we went in encampment. I thought that was kind of neat.
We'll definitely try and get a picture of that.
And I've carried it all the time, and I thought why did I didn't go back into the records and try to find this guy? I should have, I guess. But
with all
at 21, you don't think of those things till later on.
Well, I don't know. Certainly, with your great involvement with the Prairie Aviation Museum here in Bloomington, Illinois. Maybe there's an artifact for the museum at some point in time.
I suppose maybe.
With you being a board of director there and flying the DC, helping to keep the DC-3 airborne. Now, with the conclusion of the war, we talked about the various threats you faced. And did you find yourself or others around you carrying good luck charms on missions or things like that?
I guess some of them did. I don't know that I carried any. I think my good luck charm was when I was in Richmond is went on a blind date and paid $5 to go on a blind date with this gal, and it ended up we got married, and we were married for 52 years. So I don't know if it was the most expensive $5 I ever spent. It was the best $5 investment. This buddy up in Chicago, we went through pilot school together. We switched dates, just one of those deals.
Well, maybe your good luck charm
was being engaged with that gal. She was very, she said, look, I wanted to apply 51s, really. And she said, no, you stay in the jug, you'll come home.
And as you already said, it got you there and back many a time.
Got me back, yeah. And it was a good survivability aircraft. I mean, the aircraft took a lot of punishment. You can't believe the stories. The guys have holes in the wings, you know, and knock a cylinder off, and the engine would continue to run. Now, one other incident, I guess I had, we had, not only did the Pratt & Whitney engine, but we had different propellers. We had Curtis Electrics. We had Hamilton Standards. The Curtis Electrics had a tendency, the brushes would go out. When it did, the propeller went into flat pitch, which, like I turned up 3,000 RPM. Well, at 3,000 RPM, the airplane will not fly. I had to back off on manifold pressure to keep the RPM around 2,700 to keep around 170 mile hour to get the airplane home. Of course, my crew chief was mad at me when I got back. He said, how much RPM did you go? And I said, 3,000. He said, I got to change the engine. You ruined it. And I said, well, yeah, but at least I got it home. I said, when you put that other engine on there, I want a Hamilton Standard propeller. I don't want no Curtis Electric. Curtis Electric didn't have a very good reputation. They had a lot of problems with them. Mm. But that's just one of the things that happened.
So did you typically fly then with the Hamilton Standard?
Yeah, after that, the other aircraft I flew. See, like being a wingman and low man on a totem pole, when I came back from the front line, this is where our group was stationed at Stuttgart, Germany. And like we said, why didn't our wing commander tell us we were going to Stuttgart? We wouldn't have strafed it because we burned up all our hangars. We didn't have hangars for our aircraft. We lived in tar paper shacks and all that. And this is in June and July of 45 after the war was over with. But anyway.
Well, let's see, we're covering a lot of ground here, and that's great.
That.
I'm just trying to make sure what topics and how we're doing here. We're doing very well. Do you think there's anything that, whether you've seen it in movies or in books, that there's anything hasn't really been well expressed or maybe not expressed at all about things that you noticed flying combat?
Well, I tell you, History Channel is one of the greatest ones. You know, they run all the different types of aircraft on it. Of course, now I've got a bunch of the videos on the different aircraft too, the Jugs and 51s, 38s, you know. And they run a pretty true thing of it. When you're, you know, flying in that area and it's coming at you, then you look back on it, well, yeah, they're pretty accurate on that. But you don't think of it. You know, like I say, we were 21 years of age at the time. And at that age, hell, you're infallible. You know, you kick the tire, light the fire, and go.
Now, of course, the History Channel, dealing with documentaries and that sort of thing, trying to be true always to the facts.
Right.
Are there any movies, films that you think are more realistic? Of course, Hollywood always takes some license in what they present, but is there any movies to you that stand out? I remember Robert Stack, I believe, was in a movie with a Thunderbolt Squadron.
Yeah, I think he was, yeah. That was, I think, wasn't that documented from a pilot that graduated in 44A class that went through the Jugs and that he depicted and everything? And they did approximately the same thing. I've told you what I've done as being a fighter bomber pilot, more or less than an 8th Air Force escort pilot.
Mm.
I think he was the one that come up through Africa and Italy and all that kind of stuff, you know.
To what extent did you witness or perceive a concern that, you know, the phrase, some people get flak happy, and there comes a time where they just can't step up on a given day that they need a break?
We had a few pilots, I'm sure, that you might say got into the bottle a little bit, and you might say had combat fatigue, I guess they call it. You know, you got to a point, maybe.
Did you run into cases where some people were just put in the sick ward for a time to just let them, or some other type of R&R to give them a little break?
No, I didn't. I guess because, see, I got right near the end of it, and then being switched from there, went into the 10th Armored Tank Division, and come back. And so we were, we'd asked our wing, when I did, when I got back, could I go to the Pacific, finish my tour? At that time, for our group, you were supposed to fly, I think, 95 missions to finish a tour against the bombers, 35. Of course, these guys, had a lot more hours, in the air. You know, we were 30 minutes, you had a mission, you're back home. And stuff like that, maybe it was 2 hours. So there's a lot of difference in the number at the time. And he said, no, I'll go back to state for 30 days and then go to the Pacific. So that's what I was doing. I left in July, Paris in July, come back on a DC-3, Gooneyburg, landed at Bradley Field, Connecticut, stationed at Randolph Air Force Base, and then Sherman. I was, ended up at Sherman Air Force in Texas, and then I got discharged in May of 46.
And then, like first you said, you got called back.
And I stayed in reserves, and then I got recalled in January 1953 back to active duty.
And now, of course, that was now at the tail end of the Korean War.
Yeah, I was tail end of the Korean War, and during that part of it, I ended up going to Japan. I was in Japan 3 years, and I was flying the Gooneybird, but mainly the C-119 flying boxcar, hauling all different types of cargo, munitions. And while in Japan, of course, we flew into Korea, flew into Taipei, Taiwan, and the Chinese were acting up over there. We flew engine stuff in for F-86s in Taipei and Taiwan.
So the remainder of your Air Force career, yeah, you were largely in what capacity for the Air Force?
Just another pilot, and although I have run an alert area in England with 8 F-100s sitting on 50-minute alert type of thing, base operations, administrative officer. And when I retired out of Mather, another major and I, we ran what they call the mission briefing section. This is navigator training. We briefed about 350 people a day, 26 missions on the different flights that they flew out, training navigators. I did that for 2 years until I retired. Plus, still flying 70, 80 hours a month.
Now, you mentioned, you know, the C-119.
Yeah.
In your remainder of the career, of course, during the war, you're flying the P-47, then you transitioned to the cargo aircraft.
Yeah.
Did you tend to fly cargo aircraft for the remainder of your career?
No. I flew the T-29, which is the Convair 340 and 440, for navigating training. I ended up 3 years at Harlingen, 3 years at Mesa, so I flew the Convair for over 6 years. I've got about 4,000 hours in that airplane. And I was in flight test section for about a year on it, too. We were having engine problems.
Just curious, if you have a tally of the number of hours of flight time you had in the Air Force, and then I know you have quite another number of hours at State Farm as a corporate pilot.
I had 8,000 hours when I retired out of the Air Force.
8,000 in the Air Force.
And I got about 6,800 now. So
68.
Well,
since
50. Yeah, 68.
Since you retired.
Yes. Let's see. Let me check. Make sure. Yeah, I got about 14,800 hours total.
Definitely a high timer, as they say. And
hey, as the airline pilot, being a fighter pilot, single engine, see, that includes, between World War II and I got recalled in Korea, I flew for Steak and Shake Restaurant Company as a corporate pilot. We had a Beechcraft Bonanza and a Cessna 195. Flew for Gus Belt, the guy that started Steak and Shake here in Bloomington, Normal. And then there was no promotion in that. My father got ill, so I was going to go back to farming. So I went back to farming. When I was farming, also was during the time we had corn borers, so I ended up for Art Carnahan, the manager. I crop dusted for him in an Aeronica aircraft. I crop dusted in the year of 1949 and 1950. And this is not conducive to longevity.
As they
and
say.
I was farming in 1950, 160 acres, my dad's 100 acres. And then in January of 51, I got orders to report to active duty. I took my physical, had sold all my farm machinery, and 2 months later they said, no, we're not going to call you. So I had, my wife being from North Carolina, I went down to Rocky Mount, North Carolina. I got down there looking for a job, and at Kinston, North Carolina, they were starting a civilian contract school of teaching pilots to fly in the AT-6. So I went down there and signed up and got hired for that job, went through the civilian flight instructor school at Selma, Alabama. Then I was instructing cadets in the T-6 from 51 then in the fall of 51 until January of 53 on back on active duty. So see, I've been flying all the time, but I had instructed students in the T-6 when I got recalled in 53.
And what aircraft did you primarily fly for State Farm?
Well, State Farm, we had started out with a 500A Commander, it's a piston job. Then we got a 681B turboprop aero commander. We bought it in 72, and I was still flying that airplane when I retired 18 years later.
You retired from State Farm in?
With December of 89.
With 20 years of service?
Yeah, I got out in December of 69 from the Air Force. Came with State Farm. The last 11 years of State Farm, we picked up the Learjet 35 model. So I got 11 years flying Learjet with them. About 2,000 hours in that airplane.
And you've, since your retirement from State Farm, you've continued to fly private aircraft.
172s, Comanche. I owned a Comanche 250 at one time. And now I've got a Cessna 182.
Cessna 182.
But it's a 99 model. End up buying a new one.
A Cessna 182 here at 77, still yanking and banking up there in the wild blue yonder.
Right.
Very good.
If you go back and look, I've been flying 59 years now, and so far, knock on wood, I've never missed a year of flying. I've just had good health, been lucky, and just wasn't my time yet, I guess.
How many IFEs or in-flight emergencies would you say you've encountered where you thought, I'm not so sure this is going to be recoverable, so to speak?
Well, the Goonie Bird, I flew it for 7 years straight, C-47. That was 4 years up and down the East Coast. They were also flying navigators at the time. And then in England, 3 years. 7 years straight. But when we were in England, we flew into Norway, Germany, Spain, you know, all over the world, all over the Far East. So, anyway, and like say, Convair 6 years, so I had flew a lot of hours in the same aircraft. So as far as the Goonie Bird, I think I lost 4 engines. Had to shut them down, make single engine landings. The closest one on the C-47 or Goonie Bird was out of Wright-Patterson. Full load of people, full load of fuel, over gross, 85 degrees, and at 50 feet, as I pulled the gear up, the right engine caught on fire. So I had the crew chief check it because I had civilians in the back, and they said, yeah, it's on fire, so we shut it down, and I was able to go up, get 200 feet, and bring it around, and make a 9270 and land back downwind with that aircraft. That's the closest I come to losing the aircraft. I don't think I ever got over 100 mile an hour on an aircraft at the time. But it flew okay on one, I made it back.
The famed reputation of the Goonie Bird.
Good. And like co-pilot I had was a new co-pilot, and I wanted to turn in the dead engine. Don't turn it, I said, fine, it'll fly on one engine. As long as you got the airplane trimmed up, it'll fly.
And now, of course, you play an integral role at the Prairie Aviation Museum here in Bloomington to help keep their DC-3 flying.
Yeah, they get me in charge of the maintenance. Like I said, told the guys, you know, I don't cure the oil leaks on that airplane. I just slow them down, you know. But last year, I feel real lucky. We made 10 air shows, made all 10 air shows. And this year, we've made 9 air shows. And it's supposed to be airborne today going to an air show. And if they make that one, I'll have made all of them this year. And
Now, you've been...
We made a few minor adjustments, changed a few parts, carburetors, and a few things like that, but I still got it flying.
And now, you've been a board of director at the museum and involved in keeping that running since roughly when?
Well, Norm and I and two other people, four of us, really are the original, four original board of directors that started the museum back in 83.
Norm Wingler...
Is the president now, yeah, still president.
President.
I got signed as vice president, but that was by proxy, I think, in 83.
So, you've been quite one of the founding fathers of the museum. And with the museum, what is your view on the museum's contribution to the public?
Well, like you say, the idea that started was we just wanted to preserve aviation for young people to keep advised, you know, what happened, say, during World War II and Korea, and try to keep aviation alive in the community. And I think we have done that quite a bit with our different community efforts, you know, being the different parades and two, starting the aviation program at Parkside High School, and the young troops have come in, and the kids are really good. They call themselves the Soaring Cobras, and they've got a logo, and we give them airplane rides for their graduation. Last year, our aircraft happened to be down at the time for their particular graduation. I flew 21 students in the aviation program in my own aircraft. Most of them is their first time on an airplane, and also real active with the EAA, which is the Experimental Aircraft Association, flying Flight Eagles, called the Flight Eagle flights. I don't know, I've flown maybe 50 or 60 students in that particular role in the last 2 years. And I enjoy flying these young kids, see them 12 and 13. It's amazing to look at their face for their first time up. I get as much enjoyment as they do. I really do.
Well, amen. Amen. Looks like this tape is starting to wind down, and I, of course, would like to just get a few more of your views, if I may. Some overarching views on just a few points. And I think maybe at this point I'll stop the tape so I can pop in another one and just, like I say, go into some overarching.